Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hello and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Jackie Canterbury. I have two scientists today, Dr. Katie Hannon, wildlife veterinarian, and Dr. Scott Pearson, senior research scientist, both with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. They will answer questions about the recent avian flu outbreak on Rat Island off Marrowstone Island and discuss the outlook for the future. Welcome, Katie and Scott. And Katie, I met you during the beginning of the outbreak when I was a volunteer docent on the project, and you educated us all regarding the newly documented virus, which happened about a month into our docent program. And then Scott, you gave a pretty incredible presentation on seabirds to us at the beginning of the docent program, which we started this year basically to educate people about the importance of reducing disturbance on Rat Island. So thank you for your time, because I know you've been really busy with this outbreak. So I'm going to ask you some questions. And let's begin, though, please, with allowing the listeners to get to know both of you. So tell us about yourself and your role with Washington State. Start with Scott.
Hi, I'm a research scientist with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I supervise our Westside research team. And that team is composed of a group of research scientists and biologists, and also our veterinarian. And that group includes, it's quite diverse. So it's folks that are working on marine mammals and marine birds, but it's also people working in the terrestrial environment and things like large carnivores and prairie butterflies and pocket gophers. So really diverse group, and working on very diverse questions that are important to the state.
Katie.
Great, thank you. I'm a wildlife veterinarian with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I focus primarily on diversity or non-game species. So pretty much anything that's a species of greatest conservation need or listed as state endangered or threatened or federally endangered, I work with our partners on all things related to wildlife health.
Thank you both. So one of the first questions is that I think it will help our viewers is, can you provide us a visual? This is radio. So can you provide us a visual of Rat Island, followed by a description of one of the species most affected by this outbreak? And that is the Caspian tern. And then perhaps you could talk about its appearance, biology, and breeding strategy.
I'll give it a try. If you think about sort of geographically where it's located across Port Townsend Bay, and it's right offshore of Indian Island and adjacent to Marrowstone Island. And it's essentially an extension of the spit coming off of Fort Flagler out into the Salish Sea. And that spit is at times actually connected at very low tides, and the channel runs around the southern side of the island. And the island's probably about a third of a mile long, has spits at both ends, and it's very low lying. So it's probably at its highest elevation, maybe 3 meters, so 3 yards above the ocean, maybe. I don't know, and it's not very high. So it probably gets strong winds coming out of the north, probably gets some pretty high waves coming up onto it. It's mostly both unvegetated and sparsely vegetated. And it's vegetated by sort of typical coastal species we see. And what's really neat about the island is that it's separated most of the time. And so it probably doesn't have as many terrestrial predators as a lot of other places do on the mainland. And so as a result, it became a good place for some birds to nest, seabirds. And seabirds generally select sites that are offshore and are free of mammalian predators. This site does get mammalian predators sometimes. So things like raccoons and coyotes may visit the island sometimes. And it is, we see there nesting both glaucous wing gulls, or at glaucous wing and their hybrids, that species hybridizes, and we tend to call that group of hybrids, we call them Olympic gulls, because they're found off of our Olympic Peninsula in our area. And then they're also breeding Caspian terns. And the breeding of Caspian terns is relatively new. Started about, six years ago or so, when they first started using the island. Prior to that, they were breeding in other places like Dungeness Spit and a variety of other locations. And they're somewhat nomadic and moving around, trying to find good places to breed where they can be successful. hopefully that helps paint a little bit of a picture.
It does. That's excellent. And what now we're going to switch into the avian influenza. So what are the basics of the avian influenza virus, and what does H5N1 mean?
So avian influenza virus, or influenza A virus, as you may see it written in some places, it's a flu virus, and it, you know, there are many, many different strains. And if you, you know, delve into the literature on influenza A virus or flu virus or avian flu influenza viruses, it's quite complicated. But when we talk about avian influenza viruses, there's a whole bunch of influenza A viruses that infect birds. It's perfectly normal in birds. Waterfowl are considered the natural reservoir or host species for most avian influenza viruses. The low path avian influenza virus, again, it's something that's perfectly normal. Just like humans have our own versions of influenza A viruses, so do wild birds and domestic birds. And so basically H5N1 is a type of influenza A or avian influenza virus. And the way influenza A viruses are distinguished is by surface proteins on the virus. So I think we're all probably familiar with the spike protein on SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID. Avian influenza viruses have a hemagglutinin and a neuraminidase, and that's what the H and the N stands for. And those glycoproteins, or proteins on the surface of the virus, are what actually help the virus bind to a host cell and then infect the host cell and do its viral thing of replicating and, you know, taking over the host cell and making the host sick. There's 18 types of hemagglutinin and 11 types of the neuraminidase. And so depending on the type, that's where you get the H5N1 or H1N1 or whatever the variety may be. And then to add to the complication, there are different genotypes of, say, H5N1. And so I think in a few minutes, we'll probably talk a little bit more about H5N1, but there are different varieties of H5N1 itself. Just like with SARS-CoV-2 causing COVID, right? We're familiar with, you know, Omicron and the different genotypes of that virus. So it's really quite similar with the flu virus as well. So I think that's it in a nutshell.
Thank you very much. Can you differentiate the low and high pathogenicity avian influenza? And why is it important to know the difference?
Mm-hmm. In general, low pathogenicity avian influenza is widespread in waterfowl. If you were to go out on the landscape and swab a goose or a duck or, you know, a wild waterfowl bird, you would probably find low path avian influenza, perfectly normal. The high path variety is where we really start to get worried. And historically, prior to H5N1, high pathogenicity avian influenza is really a disease of domestic birds. And the high path is defined by how many domestic birds it kills if it infects a domestic bird. And so the high pathogenicity avian influenza viruses are known to kill 90 to 95% of the domestic birds that are infected. So far, we know only H5 and H7s are considered to be high pathogenicity. To add to the complications, not all H5 and H7s are high path. But it really is defined by how it impacts the domestic birds. And historically, that's, you know, been what high path AI has been of most concern, because it has huge economic consequences for international trade and domestic poultry in the United States, because there are countries that will not trade products with a country that has high path avian influenza. And then once you have, you know, been deemed to have high path AI, there's a whole series of testing and a predetermined amount of time that you must be high path AI free before you can go back to the trading. And so it really historically has been a disease or a pathogen of economic and agricultural importance prior to H5N1 hitting the landscape.
Very interesting. And, you know, so if we go to Rat Island, how has the virus, and I assume it's H5N1, affected the wildlife on Rat Island, and what kind of loss are we talking about for this year, for 2023?
Yeah, I'll try to answer that question. So we first heard about this by local people letting us know that they were seeing dead birds on the beach. And so that's the local kayaking guide and the people in the area. And they contacted us, and I happened to be on Protection Island, went out there, and we collected 5 carcasses and we tested them. And they came back, 2 of them, I think, came back positive for H5N1. So so highly pathogenic. And then we have done, since then, we have done a variety of collecting of carcasses. And essentially, they were sort of at 1 week intervals initially, and now we've let it go a little bit longer since probably most of the mortality is over. But to date, we have collected, I think, 1,071 adult carcasses of Cassiminterns just from rat and maybe adjacent at Flagler as well. And then we've had 426 chicks from Cassiminterns. And then we also have had glaucous wing slash western gull, the hybrids. And we are not trying to differentiate between the two varieties. Mm-hmm. And we just lump them. And there are 216 of those. And those are almost entirely chicks, almost no dead adult gulls. And then I guess it's okay to let you all know that we now have high-path AI detected in harbor seals. So harbor seals, we've now had how many, Katie? 12?
12 total strandings and 3 confirmed with high-path AI. The others, we don't know yet if they were associated with the virus or not.
So I have read that the transmission is mostly fecal-oral. What exactly does that mean? How are they getting this disease on this island?
Once the virus is there, it's an easier question to answer. But how the virus showed up on Rat Island in the first place is something that we're still trying to determine and figure out. But once the virus is present in a population, to the best of our knowledge and the best information we have on avian influenza and H5N1 is that it is spread primarily fecal-oral. So on the colony, I mean, obviously, there's, as they're nesting and on their scrapes for the Cassiminterns, there's a lot of feces present, and the exposure to the virus can be that way. It can also be direct transmission. So if there's a sick bird, laying on the beach and another bird comes in close contact and gets exposed to the bodily fluids, and that's how it can be exposed and infected. To date, we don't think that this version of avian influenza or H5N1 is spread aerosolized. So it's not like you breathe out particles and then inhale the particles. That said, when we as humans are working on Rat Island, the gulls very much like to defecate directly on you. It's a behavioral mechanism. And so in that case, the virus can be aerosolized and basically fecal particulate. So we do take extra precaution for ourselves in that.
Interesting. And are colony nesting marine birds more susceptible to this virus?
We think they are, yes. So if you look at, it's coming to us in the Pacific Ocean much later than where it's hit elsewhere. So it's already circulated through parts of the Atlantic and down in South America. It's hit a variety of species really hard. It's hit penguins really hard. In some locations, it hit sandwich terns. In the Atlantic, it hit gannets really hard. Actually, really extreme examples of gannets. And it seems like surface nesting seabirds, birds that nest on the surface, which is in contrast to something like a tufted puffin or a rhinoceros auklet, which burrows into the ground. So those surface nesting seabirds that have nests very close to each other, they're usually within a meter often of each other, they're very close and high density, those birds are probably at higher risk. Whether or not there's something phylogenic, so depending on are there certain taxonomic groups that are more vulnerable? We don't know. It appears to be there is, because we're certainly seeing things like ducks being reservoirs and surviving pretty well. But then we see species like terns where the mortality is extremely high.
Yeah, that mortality rate about, because I remember when, I was doing the docent program and we were counting birds out there. We estimated about 1,000. Obviously, we were really low. So that's probably about an 80% mortality rate, isn't it? Of Cassiminterns, which is pretty high. All right, so if you are just tuning in, I'm your host, Jackie Canterbury. We are speaking with Dr. Katie Hannon and Dr. Scott Pearson about the recent avian flu outbreak on Rat Island off Marrowstone Island. So it's been said, I found this fascinating, Katie, and I think it was when I read your really incredible compilation of facts on a PowerPoint. And you mentioned that it's been said that the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic was an avian influenza virus. Is that true?
We think it's true. The literature is, there's, if you were to look in the literature, there's several different kind of conflicting theories. And initially, unfortunately, during the 1918 flu pandemic, samples were not collected, right? They did not confirm that it was a specific type of flu at the time. And so what has been done looking back historically with, you know, at archived samples and using modern genetic techniques. And there is a recent study from the mid-2000s that did indicate, basically did a whole bunch of genotyping of the virus from that time during that pandemic. And they were able to directly link it back to an avian influenza H1N1 that then, you know, got into humans. And as it was in the, you know, human, a mammal, the genetics of the virus then changed to make it more infectious to humans. And so there's really solid scientific evidence at this point that that pandemic, that 1918 flu pandemic, did in fact come from an avian influenza virus.
And how has H5N1 evolved?
That is also a very good question. I mean, there's a couple of really interesting papers out on the evolution of H5N1. The original H5N1 that we know of was first documented in 1996 in Guangdong, China, from some very large domestic poultry farms. So the thought is that it probably evolved from previous versions of avian influenza, you know, in the early 1990s. And since 1996, we've seen it spread, you know, globally. And then, you know, now what we're looking at with the wild birds is what's known as the Eurasian H5N1 2.3.4.4b. That's the specific genotype. And it does appear that that specific genotype of H5N1 is much more detrimental to wild birds.
Yeah, that was my next question, which I find fascinating. And because I read that the H5N1 is different and may be deadlier to wild birds. So that is true.
Mm-hmm. To the best of our knowledge, and I think we're still learning a lot about H5N1. Historically, high path avian influenza was really a disease of domestic birds. So you would have the low path AI circulating in your waterfowl. It would spill over as low path AI into a flock of chickens or a domestic flock. In that domestic flock, it would then do what flu viruses do. It would mutate and become a high path variety. And then very rarely did we see it spill back from domestics into wild birds. Very, very rarely. It did happen, but not often. But prior to H5N1 being on the landscape and in wild birds, there's never been a high path avian influenza virus that circulates and is maintained in wild birds. And if we look at what's happened in Europe, it hit Europe several years, or about a year and a half, maybe before it hit North America. And they're still seeing it circulate and cause, you know, significant mortality in some of the wild bird species there.
And when you talk about wild birds, are you talking about ducks predominantly, or can it cross over, say, to songbirds?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's predominantly the birds that are being impacted the most are seabirds, as Scott mentioned. Seabirds and sea ducks and the colonial ground nesters seem to be the hardest hit. We do see a pretty big impact on scavenging birds and raptors, because they're also infected when they scavenge on or, you know, eat an infected bird. There's a study that came out earlier this year out of Georgia and Florida that shows that there's potentially a pretty big negative impact on bald eagles and the success of reproduction in bald eagles in Georgia and Florida associated with this H5N1. So there, you know, the potential for it to have a really big impact on scavengers and raptors is also there.
Yeah, bald eagles as scavenger, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that it has infected harbor seals. How does that happen?
From Rat Island, the thought is it's just transmission because of the number of sick and dead birds on the island and the environmental contamination of the H5N1. We do know that flu viruses can survive in the environment for a prolonged period of time. They're pretty rapidly inactivated by heat, but they can survive fairly well when it's cool or damp. And so certain conditions can prolong the virus in the environment. And the, you know, the thought is that on Rat Island, the seals were hauling out directly on the beach right in front of the Caspian tern colony. And so their level of exposure to the virus was just very high.
And orca whales eat seals, right? Could it be transmitted to an orca whale?
I sure hope not.
Me too.
But potentially, we have, there have been other cetaceans that were infected with this H5N1. There's a bottlenose dolphin from Florida. So the potential is there. Whether or not they would receive an infectious dose capable of making them sick, you know, we don't know at this point. We do know that H5N1, the current H5N1 as it is right now, is not well adapted to mammals. It does infect mammals. It does make them sick. But the thought is it's, you know, based on the relative dose of the virus, so, you know, when they're exposed to a really high dose. And there's no documented or proven transmission between mammals of H5N1 yet. So that's also really key in understanding the epidemiology of this virus.
Yeah, very similar to COVID, right? Where you have to have a high dose. Very interesting. And so can it be transmitted to dogs?
Yes. It's very, very infrequent. But there have been several domestic dog cases of H5N1. And dogs, to make influenza A viruses more complicated, dogs have their own variety of canine influenza, which is also an influenza A virus. But there are several cases where dogs have become ill from being exposed to H5N1.
And how about cats?
Mm-hmm. Cats as well.
Same. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. We've actually had a bobcat, a wild bobcat from Washington was confirmed positive for H5N1.
And can the disease jump to humans?
Sure hope not. At this point, there have been very, very few cases of H5N1 in humans in North America. I want to say one, maybe two. And those were directly related to people who were depopulating poultry farms that had H5N1. And so, again, the exposure and the infectious dose was just really, really big. So thankfully, for as of now, this strain of H5N1 does not seem to infect readily infect humans.
Okay.
But the concern is always, you know, as it gets into a mammal, flu viruses mutate very rapidly. And, you know, as it's in a mammal like a seal or a bobcat or a bear, the chances of it gaining mutations that make it so that it can more easily infect mammalian cells increases. And so that's really the concern, is as it infects more mammals, the risk goes up. But for now, the CDC still considers the human health risk for H5N1 very low.
Thank you. And last question is, what are the next steps for the state? I know it's quite complicated, quite expensive. I also know that the docent program will continue next year. So we'll try to keep, you know, if I'm a part of it, educate people. But what are the next steps for you?
Maybe I'll start.
Please.
Katie, finish. But I think at first we're going to reflect and look at what we've learned from this event. And also what others have learned. We're actually talking about organizing a symposia coming up at the Pacific Seabird Group meeting, which will occur in Seattle, to discuss it. And it'll be a time to think about what do we know about the science, bring another scientist from other parts of South America and from Europe, and to think about what did we learn? What did we see? What were the events? How did they happen? Are there anything that we can do? And by that, I mean, what can we do to maybe protect or reduce the mortality in wild birds? Second thing is, how did we respond in terms of notifying the public and sort of management of public and relationship to the disease, letting people know, keeping people away, and doing appropriate signage? You know, how do we did that? Should we do things differently? Did it seem like it worked well? Did it not? It also means a time to reflect with our partners at Department of Health and our partners at state parks and NOAA, and think about how we can collaborate better in response. So those are kind of my initial thoughts on that topic.
Thank you. Katie, do you have anything to add?
I think Scott covered it very well. I think from my perspective, too, just continuing to monitor and conduct diagnostics on, you know, suspected H5N1 or HypathAI cases in wild birds, just so we can continue to collect data on the species that may be infected. And so just, you know, to encourage the general public to report sick and dead wildlife to the agency if they come across it, just so that we can continue to monitor that type of work, or sorry, that type of, you know, mortalities.
Sure.
I didn't say
yes.
That very well. But.
Yes, no, you did. Thank you for what you do, both Katie and Scott. We hope you have learned from our program today regarding the avian flu outbreak on Rat Island.
We owe a debt of gratitude to both Dr. Katie Hammond and Dr. Scott Pearson, both with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Service. They have taken their valuable time to educate us about a very important topic. Thank you again, Katie and Scott. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich. Nature Now podcasts are available on the KPTZ website and also on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening.
To end today with the Caspian Tern, we're going to play some calls first of the Caspian Tern. And the most commonly heard call from adults is a very loud, gravelly, rolling call given as an alarm call often or a contact call because they are so close in their colony. The second one will be a juvenile begging call, and that's a weaker sounding whistle and it goes ree. So we're going to play some of those so you can appreciate the loud voices and calls coming from Rat Island right now. And thank you very much for listening.